Yeah. Okay. So thanks a lot for giving me the opportunity to talk about our results that we obtained for the ironic tides, and in particular the magnetic and superconducting phases contained therein. So as you've seen in the first week, Andrei Benevik already gave a nice talk on the different perspectives on the NICTIDES from the strong coupling perspective and the weak coupling perspective. And Werner Hanke yesterday already gave a very nice introduction on the method that we have been predominantly using to investigate those compounds, namely the FRG. So luckily, I don't have to talk about this anymore and can rather constrain your and my attention to the physics contained in the NICTIDES, which is what I will do in the following 10 minutes. And actually, it's going to be kind of a challenge to do what I plan in these 10 minutes, but I hope that I can convince you from a minimal picture on all superconducting phases in the NICTIDE compounds that can be assumed to be nicely described from an itinerant or, in a rather synonymous way, weakly to intermediately coupled compounds. And so let me start with actually what the toolkits will be for this minimal picture. First, maybe just still a short comment on the collaborations. I already mentioned Werner Hanke and Andrei Benevik, who both talked here. A large part of the calculations have been done by Christian Platt at Würzburg and also involved in the collaboration has been Jianping Hu from IOP Beijing and Purdue, and Carsten Honerkamp, who's also in the audience. So, and for the papers, actually, since I'm also the wiki sort of host for this conference, at least let's, if we try to get into the talk and review what this guy, what this person was actually talking about, maybe it's a nice idea to advertise the opportunity to present yourself in a certain couple of lines and also to provide links to the papers related to that workshop. So I did this for my talk. So let me shortly give you the three main aspects that I think are essential to provide the toolkit to understand the superconducting phases in the NICTIDES from this perspective. So the first thing that we need, main ingredient, is the Fermi surface topology. I'm sorry for this Fermi surface. Topology. What I mean by that is that we, by now, all experiment and all the data at hand converge on the picture that we are basically dealing with hole pockets at gamma, and I'll just be talking about the unfolded Brillouin zone, at gamma and M, possibly at M, so we'll come to that. We'll be also talking about electron pockets at the pi 0, 0 pi location in the unfolded Brillouin zone. And this is basically what we're dealing with. We're dealing with multiple Fermi surfaces. The second ingredient that we need is the interaction and how it looks like. And so let me write interactions here. So we are basically assuming the most complete orbital-dependent local interaction type of structure consisting of intra-orbital interactions U1, inter-orbital interactions U2, Hund's coupling J-Hund, and pair hopping J-pair. So as a rather generic idea, what the scales are that we're dealing with in the NICTIDES, let me assume for the time being that U1 is larger than all the other scales, followed by U2, and then followed by J-Hund, which sort of is at the same order of magnitude as J-pair. I guess that's a fair statement on this abstract scale of consideration. So then the third ingredient, which is the main thing that actually I want to constrain your attention to, is the orbital weights along the Fermi surface. So let me plot that. Let me write this again. Orbital weights along the Fermi surface. And this is basically pretty much everything that we need to sort of understand just from the knowledge of the ab initio data, for example, that could be provided by groups like Jose Valenti, who will be talking afterwards, or by groups like Masatoshi Imada and other people, to determine what we should expect for these superconducting phases. So just as a side remark, and the 10 minutes constraint won't allow me to go in more detail, this idea that there are orbital weights along the Fermi surface and we need to take them into account is already highly relevant for the magnetic phases as well. As we know, the STW is nodal in the nictides, and you could never get this type of nodal behavior from a purely constant band interaction picture. So what you actually would like to have, but the generic feature will be the generic feature of the nodal STW is tied to the fact that we're actually dealing with orbital weights and differing orbital weights along the Fermi surface. Let me now discuss different compounds and how we just basically understand them and their superconducting properties. So as has been already elaborated on both by Thomas Meyer and by Werner Hanke, we can start and discuss the 1-1-1-1 compounds, and in particular discuss the discrepancy between the phosphorus-based compounds and the arsenic compound. So let me plot here lanthanum iron arsenide, and here lanthanum iron phosphide. So if we plot the Fermi surface topology, let's start with one. So then it will basically look like that. So we will have this is the unfolded Brillouin zone, so this is pi, this is pi zero. And I will keep this notation for all the plots I'll be showing. So then we will have a structure like that. So two hole pockets at gamma, electron pockets here. And what is most essential here, a fifth hole pocket at the end point. So now let me draw what the orbital weights are. And the main orbital weights we'll be dealing with are just given by dxz, dyz. Can you see that blue over there? Okay, let me try another color. Can you see that? Is it better? Simon is still hesitating. So, okay, let me try. Okay, so then we have, and then we have dxy. So these are the two, these are the three main orbitals that we'll be dealing with, and for the lanthanum, for the arsenic compound, we'll be dealing with a structure like this. So let me still plot the Fermi surface for that guy. So then what we will have is that the dxy largely populates the front tips of the electron pockets and the hole pocket at the end point, while the dxz, dyz basically populates the rest of the Fermi surfaces. So let me just highlight that in a double way. Like, yeah, they change, but let me just say that this is dxz, dyz. So what we can see from here then is, as has already been talked about by Werner Hanke, is that since this M pocket in the arsenic-based compound stabilizes, also contributes to the scattering channel of pi 0, 0 pi, this fifth hole pocket actually manages to stabilize the gap S plus minus and also increases the magnetic fluctuations along the pi 0, 0 pi channel, which is why we can already see from this basic argument that the tendency to the propensity to form a magnetic instability in the arsenic based compound is higher than in a phosphorus compound. The other aspect is, and I don't have time to go this into much detail, is that since this front tip of the electron pockets are dxy populated, in the dominant regime where U1, the intra-orbital interaction, is the dominant energy scale, these front tips don't manage to efficiently contribute to the pi-0-0-pi channel, and instead rather efficiently scatter along pi-pi, which is the reason for this frustration argument also raised by Werner Hanke yesterday, that we actually find a tendency to increase anisotropy in the phosphorus compounds, and it was also raised by Thomas Meyer in his talk. So we can already infer from these both statements that we would expect a higher magnetic phase propensity for the arsenic compound and a more stable gap S plus minus, while we would expect a decreased magnetic propensity for the phosphorus compound and a rather enlarged anisotropy of the superconducting form factor, which both actually matches with experiment. So let me go now on to a new compound that was raised by let me start with another compound that may be actually more interesting because it will show a D-wave instability. Let me now talk about, this is S plus minus, so let me wrap up what the result here is. SDW, S plus minus, gapped, SDW, S plus minus nodal. Let me now show you a different scenario, which we recently worked on, and which is a preprint that will appear on the archive tomorrow, which is about the potassium-doped iron arsenide. So if we look at the 1-2 compounds and we dope, we interchange barium by potassium, so basically we're looking at the compound potassium barium 1 minus X Fe2 arsenide 2, then what you find from the ARPIS data by Hong Ding is that for the strongly potassium-doped case, the electron pockets are completely gapped out. So you see hardly any resonances around the endpoint of the folded Brillouin zone, which is why we conclude that, and also substantiated from the band structure, that this compound in the case of X around 1 is most efficiently be described by a band structure that looks sort of like this. So this is the unfolded Brillouin zone. So if you fold it back and look at the ARPIS data by Hong Ding, then you would actually expect just resonances to be located around the gamma point. And since this M pocket is of a similar size as the larger hole pocket at the gamma from the band structure, it can either be like a two-pocket scenario or a three-pocket scenario, but let me not get into that. The main message here is, while you've seen the 1-1-1-1 compounds, that the main scattering channels are oriented along pi 0 and 0 pi, the main scattering channels here are now oriented along pi pi. And this naturally gives us the background to make the statement that here the superconducting instability will be of D-wave type. There's no electron pocket here. The electron pockets are gone, they are gapped out. So this compound, let me go into more detail and let me make these plots again because I like them here, because it already helps to substantiate the claim that I'm going to. Sorry? Okay. So then let me plot, just for comparison, this new compound, this potassium intercalated iron selenide. So while this is just at a comparatively premature state, you can think of that this is just the inverse situation of what I've been explaining here. In that case, all the hole pockets are gone, and you're just left with the electron pockets. So then you would have just electron pockets located like this. So this would be the two Fermi surface topologies that I would claim are more or less significant for both compounds. And what they have in common is that their main scattering channel is now of pi pi, and definitely different to the previous nictite compounds that we've seen. Now, let me, as a last detail, let me make one last comment on why the TC in the intercalated iron selenide may be way larger than in the potassium-doped iron arsenide. And basically, all I need are these colors. And with this, I will stop, Peter. So as you see here is like what we find, and now I would have to go into more detail what the FRG calculation actually gives us. But what you see here is that the pi-pi channel, we still have the intra-pocket pi-pi channel because the pockets are so large that their linear extent is nearly of that appropriate order to have an intra-pocket pi-pi channel. But in addition to that, you see that the pi-pi channel between the pockets is governed by U2 interaction in the potassium dot iron arsenide compound. While for the electron pockets in the potassium intercalated iron selenide, this inter-pocket interaction is still of U1 type because both electron pockets share the same orbital content, while the potassium dope does not share the same orbital content. I claim this is one major idea to understand, one aspect to understand why the TC of this compound is just TC, I forgot the numbers, and I think 4 Kelvin or something. Is that right? 3 Kelvin. 3 Kelvin. And this can be of the order of 30. 40 even? Well, okay. So while these structures, I think this recoupling picture is very, very similar, I guess that this aspect of the band structure, which you again can understand in this elementary toolkit, will be one major component to understand the differing critical temperature. Thanks a lot. Yeah, so of course now the compound that we studied in very great detail is this compound, and there you already know what happens. So the nodes are located around that, so you will indeed have nodes. Here, obviously, you can also think of a D wave that does if you just continue that, if you just had this type of D wave, then you would up with no nodes along the Fermi surfaces. Now here comes the point that this argument that I raised, just like by now we only studied this correspondence, we just studied on an abstract level of the main statements I did. So this is the pi-pi channel, we did some runs, but in order to get a more detailed picture here, one would be in need of a better band structure and knowledge of more aspects of this compound. Another aspect, for example, is the dispersive feature in this compound, which is probably way higher than in that, because if you go to the strongly hole-doped case and the 1-2-2, you see that basically the dispersive features of the hole pockets along KZ is rather negligible. So I think this picture is way more settled when it comes to the question that first, the 2D picture is applicable. Second, we really know well the band structure due to your studies. And here, I think it's still an ongoing, it's far from being settled. What I try to highlight is that there is definitely a relation, and I assume that the pi-pi channel in both systems will definitely be the relevant channel. Yeah. Let me not comment further on that. I don't want to exceed the elementary picture that I've just shown you. In order to do more, I actually would have to go into the FLG calculation and tell you more details. What did you say? Arsenic, potassium? So does this relate to the question you had in the first week of the conference, where you said that the five pocket picture? So let me try to answer. As far as I understood, also the data that we know by Kuroki. The fifth pocket that may appear in the phosphor-based compounds is of Z-squared type. So you can have, like, if you look at the band structure, at the endpoint, the hole pocket of DXY type and the hole pocket of Z-squared type switch roles. And you can actually imagine that you may have an M pocket at the endpoint. But what I want to what I want to emphasize here is that this pocket needs to have share orbital character with the electron pockets. And my claim is that for the purely phosphor-based compounds, at least from the band structures that I have studied, this whole M pocket that appears is of Z square type. So it would not, it would only interact with these other pockets through U2. And if you assume a U1 dominated interaction, it would be negligible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is known from the very earliest paper by Kuroki, where he shows that if you vary the nictogen height, the bands, the DXY dominated whole band and the DZ squared dominated whole band change roles as you increase the nictogen height. They just switch roles. Yeah. We have in detail studied this because we didn't have band structures at hand for this compound. So we see that the magnetic fluctuations in both channels are rather small, but the pi pi channel is largely is emphasized as compared to the pi zero in this compound. But they are both. Yeah, but you see, they are both very small. And from the discussions we had last week also, what Zlatko said that, yeah, no, in a recoupling picture, you need some sort of instability in the particle hole channel, and then go like the seeding picture, that the particle hole instability sort of seeds the superconducting instability. In that recoupling picture, this also becomes understandable that this compound is rather small, like this has a rather small TC. And it really also matches here because this is of 7 Kelvin, and the STW fluctuations are largely suppressed, and this is of, I think, 30 Kelvin, and the STW fluctuations are large. And by the way, this is a nice feature of FRG because we can look at the STW fluctuations and the superconducting fluctuations on the same footing. So this is more or less the only method, I would say, from this recoupling perspective that can make this joint, that can provide this joint perspective. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, I had no time to talk about this. In this 1 second when I shortly stopped and went on to this, I wanted to talk about lithium iron arsenide, but I was aware of the time constraint. But we looked at this, and we already had intense discussions with Jeroen van den Brink. And what we find is that the FRG result tends to... Yeah, so let me shortly answer that and not go into details. The main feature of the band structure, and let me forget everything. The main feature is this small hole pocket at gamma. And the size of this hole pocket and the treatment from whatever effective theoretical method basically tells you whether these ferromagnetic fluctuations induced by this small hole pocket will be enough to see the P-wave superconductivity or not. From the FRG calculations that we have done by now, starting from the best ab initio data at hand by, for example, by IMADA, which also provides constrained RPA interaction parameters, we have rather seen the tendency that the S plus minus wins. But I think the generic question is, what is the dominant feature in the band structure that decides between the P wave and the S plus minus? And I think there is a complete correspondence between the studies by Van den Brink's group and ours, that we basically find that the small hole pocket gives the dominant resource and the dominant competing aspect between ferromagnetic fluctuations and antiferromagnetically driven S plus minus fluctuations. I mean, like, you will have scattering contribution. So this linear, if you take this pocket, like, it gets so large that also the intra, as I try to explain, the intra pocket scattering can already be of pi pi. Okay. Oh yeah, but isn't that more or less a, I'm not sure, is that? Isn't that the trivial statement then? Because, I mean, if I have pi pi and I go to the, I fold back to the zone, then pi minus pi gives zero?
Yeah, so why is P wave not
here? Oh, I would just say it. So if you start with magnetic fluctuations in the pi channel, and you think of a seeding picture, then it would drive the D wave fluctuations. So it's in the same channel.
You don't start with magnetic fluctuations. You start with
interaction. Okay. So then let me just say that this is what we find. I mean, first of all, this is what we find from FOG. Let me think more about it. I was so, like, when I saw the pi channel, like, yeah, okay, D wave. Maybe I should. One has to think more about it, but this is definitely the result that we get from FOG. We find the nodes, we find the nodes along these dashed lines, so this all seems consistent. Yeah.
But actually, related to what Peter's question, I was thinking in a different way, that if I think about the system being strongly folded, then both these additional electrical traffic in common will also sit on the gallon. Now, if you think about that, that's a particle, so that sheet of the research, this with the central sheet, which is almost the same size, is a particle. So one can imagine the possibility that you might have enhancement of the superconducting interference of the grid venture because you have now nesting in the particle chain. The question is, why does that help if you don't have that at all? Okay. No, I'm talking about a particle interference for that work. Not in any system. Right?
You
this is a question of that. I got the D wave for all the elements of bare parameter, or you have a sub region of bare parameter from which you get D wave.
So for the time being, we studied this scenario and varied U1 versus U2 up to 30% or something. No, wait a second. No, I don't think this is true because the vertices we start with are all positive.
But you start with positive vertices, U wave interaction is always a different.
Yeah, I have to think more about this and study more detail.
So, how seriously I should take this suggestion of comparison between transient and transient and potassium arsenide, given that the normal state
of the system? Oh, I'm just giving you. I just wanted to provide the thoughts I had in the last week during the workshop, and I just put this on to discussion. I'm not saying that this explains everything. This is why I chose a minimal picture. I just find it quite appealing that, and I think you will agree with that, that in the one case we have pure hole pockets, in the other case we have pure electron pockets, and the dominant scattering channel most likely is situated along pi. No? Andre, what?
No, my point is that it is better.
My interest is that iron selenide is some compound, iron selenide compound is very dirty. And
it definitely does not give the full picture, 100% sure, right? I'm just saying that I find that this. I totally agree with that. I totally agree that all the details that enter this new compound are way more like it still have to be discussed in way more detail, and this doesn't even give a qualitative, exhausting view on this compound. Yeah, just take this as a starting point for discussion this week.
My
Yeah, let me short. Last comment on that, because I can advertise your group on that. Because actually the band structure that we use, thank you. So this band structure that we use here, you're totally right. So like this unfolding the band structure in 1 to 2 into one iron per unit cell is basically a delicate issue. So what we used here is the band fitted band structure that was obtained by Siegfried Graser already a while ago, basically what I'm arguing here is our statement is around this largely whole dope case. So the details that may differ in the band structures, and you can argue about this, and I'm definitely sure that for the electron doped case, there are these issues, and you need to look at the very like 2 iron per unit cell folded band structure. But for this scenario, I think it's fairly safe to use this band structure.
So my question is that don't you think that iron?
Could you say that again?
I
agree. So. As I said, the line nodes is an issue that has to be discussed, and it can only be discussed by looking at the 3D dispersive features. I agree. This may be an issue for the electron doped case, but as I tried to say, for the purely hole doped, for the strongly hole doped case, if you look at the hole pockets along KZ, they're not strongly dispersive. So I think it's a fair approximation to go to the 2D approximation in that case. Yeah.
I have to apologize because I was told 10 minutes ago that it should be on the blackboard, but I mainly have pictures, so I will do it on the computer. So sorry for that. But I can discuss anything on the blackboard that is needed. So let's see. Do something now. No input. Oh. I don't know. It should work. I mean, this is PowerPoint, so it always works. So, can anybody help me? I don't get it. No, it's PowerPoint. Do you know how I should? F7. Yeah. Now I got it. Yeah. Which one? Now it's working, huh? Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. So what I would like now is just a little bit of a continuation to what Leonardo De Giorgi presented. So in fact, I want to present some results on these optical conductivity calculations. First of all, what do we learn from density functional theory calculations? And then I will present some comparison between density functional theory calculations on LDA plus DMFT. So at least we get an idea of how far can we push these density functional theory calculations to understand, and here I will concentrate on the spin density wave state that was so much discussed this morning, and then when do we really need to include these quantum fluctuations, at least at the level as it is done in the DMFT. So this was already discussed this morning, so since I don't have that much time, I will just skip this transparency, and mainly here I'm presenting the, where is the pointer? There's here, oh, there's this one pointer. And mainly, as it was discussed this morning, we have here in this region that is important in the spin density wave, so these are the results of these nice between crystals, where we have this region which, when you enter the spin density wave, is depressed, so this spin density wave region, and then we have an enhancement here of this peak or shoulder, and then we have at larger frequency this large peak. And what first I will do is I will concentrate on this region here, whether we can describe that by DFT. There is one important point that we have to consider here. As you well know, when we do density functional theory calculations in a magnetic state, if we have the right structure, we get always over the value of the magnetic moment is very large. And this is going to have an important consequence on these optical conductivity properties, because if we have a too large magnetic moment, then we get this region here, which is the region of the spin gap, very large. So we get everything displaced far away in frequency. So the first thing we have to do, if we want to still use DFT, is try to reduce this magnetic moment. And you see here, by looking at the density of states, where we can already get an idea of the possible electron hole excitations that we will have in optical conductivity. So these are, let's say, this is for strontium-122. This is the GGA, so non-spin polarized. And now when I do the spin polarized calculation, I get a large spin gap. And now the question is, how can I get this reduced magnetic moment? So a way to do that is by considering the so-called LDA plus U or GGA plus U. As you well know, this approach was introduced many years ago by Zanon and also Anisimov and Ole Anderson in order to describe MOT insulators. And the idea is to introduce on a mean field level this extra U, Hubbard U term in the LDA Hamiltonian, and then I can describe a MOD insulator. Now, what is important about this approach is, since in LDA or GGA, we already have in some way correlations, when we include an extra term, U, that also describes correlations, we have a double counting. And what is very important is how we take care of this double counting, and there are different approaches to take care of the different of this double counting. One is the so-called atomic limit, the other one is the mean field, and depending on which double counting you are considering in your calculations, you can get quite different results. So this is still an open question that we also have in the MFT. Now, here what I want to show you is that if we consider the atomic limit double counting, what we are doing to our LDA Hamiltonian is we are adding such a term. And if you look at this term, you see that if I put that this factor in front of it, which is U minus J, J the Kunth exchange, what it's doing with a negative factor here, it's basically favoring small magnetic moment and penalizing large magnetic moment. So the idea is, and here you just have to think not so much on a physical term, but on a way of reducing this magnetic moment in the DFT, what we will do is we will consider a negative value of this U minus J, and then we get a reduction of the magnetic moment. And if you look at what happens when I put a negative U effective, I get this reduction of this spin density wave gap. And if I go to values that are pretty large here in the region when I get where I get the magnetic moment of the system, I see that at high energies, so in the in the conduction van, I don't do much change to the system, and everything that is changed is here, similar to the electromagnetic case. So this is this method, I can use it now in order to calculate the linear optical response, which we do, as we said, by considering the dielectric function and where our orbitals will be the Konchan orbitals, and we stay in the dipole approximation. So let me show you here the results for various systems, and now I'm in the region of energies where we saw where we have this spin density gap and then this enhancement of weight just above this depletion of weight. So what we see here, this is for strontium iron 122. These are the experimental results, and this is now the results obtained by DFT. As you, we didn't here put any Lorentzian broadening so that we can see the features for this case. And what you see that is qualitatively there is a good agreement. So you can explain by doing DFT calculation on a given magnetic ordering, and by considering this reduced magnetic moment, you can reproduce these features of optical conductivity. And what is important is also the magnetic ordering. If you change the magnetic ordering, these features are very different. They change a lot. And what here is important is this optical conductivity is the average between the A and B. So it's sigma AA plus sigma BB divided by 2. And what we see is this anisotropy that was described this morning in these two peaks here. So this first peak corresponds to the sigma AA, and the second peak corresponds to the sigma BB. And moreover, you can do an analysis within this DFT of the different kind of orbital transitions that are contributing to this peak here. So we see mainly that the orbital that mostly contributes in the transition in this, for this feature in the optical conductivity, is the XZ orbital and the XY orbital. So these are the transitions that are larger in this optical conductivity. And now the same is for the 122 system. You get also these features qualitatively explained, and the and for europium iron 122 and the last wall. It's also a good description. What is interesting here in these two systems, in the europium and the strontium, is this feature at very low energies. It was discussed by the experimentalists, this one here and this one here, that most probably this is a phononic excitation. And here what we see that this is in fact an electronic excitation, because we don't have any phonon in the calculation. Now, let me go to larger energies. And what do we see here when we go to larger energies? This is the peak that we discussed. And now when I go to larger energies, I see that this broad peak that we saw this morning in this range of energies from 0.3 to 0.6 electron volts, we don't get it in the DFT calculations. And moreover, when we go to larger energies, we see features in the DFT calculations that are not seen in experiment. But I was just talking with Leonardo Di Giorgi, and you were saying that, in fact, in your between experiments, you do see features here at this large range of energies, which is good news, because you would expect that these features, which are interband transitions, are well explained by DFT calculations. So this is, now let me compare that. In this figure, it's always, and this is now what I'm going to discuss, I always have to, in order to compare the experiment with theory, I have to do this multiplication by 2. And this has to do with the renormalization of the bands. Yes, you always have to do this multiplication, which is... No, I do the calculation without changing. The only thing that I do, I rescale the experimental results, you know, experimental data, in order to put that on the same scale.
Oh,
yes. 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 And this is what I want to discuss now in the comparison between DFT calculations and LDA plus DMFT. So this is the comparison with the results from Jean, Christian Howell, and Gabby Kotlia. This is a nice paper where they do, in fact, LDA plus DMFT calculations on the barium 1-2 compound, and they analyze this region of energies that I was discussing with the DFT calculations. And what we see is they obtained the features that we already see in the DFT, so these features about this peak, then you have this shoulder here, then this maximum, and then the second shoulder is also obtained here. But first of all, they don't have to reduce the magnetic moment, so this is already when you introduce this local quantum fluctuations in the calculation, you already get magnetic moments, at least in their calculation, that are comparable to experimental magnetic moments. And the second point, and I think this is the important point, is that they don't have to do any scaling in principle. And we see that also in the comparison between the recent experiments from Richard and collaborators, where they do ARPIS in the spin density wave region for this 1-2 compound, and they see this let me just show you here, this Dirac cone. So what I'm comparing is GGA, this GGA plus U effective, and the LDA plus DMFT results. We see that, of course, GGA doesn't agree with this ARPIS, but GGA plus this U effective has, in fact, the features that is in an experiment give a description very similar to this LDA plus DMFT. So my point is that, again, here, of course, to do that, I have to do the renormalization. Here is without renormalization. So my point is that DFT already give us a lot of information about this system, and we have to keep in mind that DFT also doesn't have any spin fluctuations, any quantum fluctuations properly taken account of, but nevertheless, we can get a lot of information on the magnetic properties of the system and these results observed in optical conductivity. But if we want to get correctly the renormalization factors, one has to do then LDA plus DMFT, at least a treatment where one treats these quantum fluctuations properly. Maybe just to give a little bit more of weight here at this point is, of course, these calculations are very fast. These calculations need more time, but it's interesting to compare them. Yes, the color background is the experiment. No, what I'm saying is, well, DMF, the topology looks right, yeah. I don't really fit it, so I don't really, of course, you would like to get it like that, right, to get it. But it's really the features with the coloring, it's okay. Just compare with here. You see here you are really off. If you compare this one with this one, yeah. It's better than GGA, yeah. It's better than GGA, it's not perfect, but the shades seem to be fine, I would say. I mean, if I look at the shapes, seem to be fine, and they look very similar to also these calculations here. But here I have to do the renormalization, there I don't. So again, this is an indication that correlations and fluctuations are important. This U effective is the one that I put in order to get this reduced magnetic moment. So for all these calculations, I have to do it with reduced magnetic moment. Yeah. But right. So here I need to have the moment as the experimental moment. That's why I have to put this U negative. If I put the U positive, I'm completely off. Yeah. This is 0.6, 0.7 million newborn. The negative U is minus 1.8, minus 1.7. So U minus J. Huh? Yeah, so these are the values. But one, as I say, one has to be careful about what it means, this U negative. Well, and here I just come to the results that one can, within DFT, explain quite a few features of these optical conductivity results. But we need to scale our results if we want to compare with experiment. And we have a strong renormalization of the kinetic energy. So by just looking at this quotient that was discussed this morning, we still have that for at least the system that we discussed more, we have ratios that are very small. So correlations are important in this material. And this is also what one obtains from analysis of this optical conductivity experiment. Yes? Yes. Yes, you mean now, wait a second. I'm the optical conductivity? Well, but I'm just comparing the optic. Yes, yes, I think I have a picture here. This is GGA, right? So this is without magnetic order. I do have it here in the previous transparency. It's here. You see, it's GGA. You see nothing. It's to be expected that you see nothing because you are in this spin density wave regime. So you have this ordering. And if you do GGA non-spin polarized, you have no order, nothing. If I do? Yes, non-magnetic is GGA. So if you do a non-spin polarized calculation, this is what you're asking, so no magnetic moment, then it's to do just GGA. And GGA just gives you no structure at all at these small omegas. This is non-spin polarized. This is GGA, but spin polarized antiferromagnetic without giving any reduction to the magnetic moment. So this would be with these overestimated magnetic moments. And what happens is if you follow that, then you will start seeing this feature here at higher energies. And this is now with magnetic order, but reducing the magnetic moment. So all the features that you saw shift here, and you can compare with experiment. Maybe this. So maybe we can see here in this picture, because you see at low frequencies, you don't have any information from the non-spin polarized calculation. But up to here, where the interband transitions at larger energies are the ones that play a role, here you see that both the non-spin polarized and the spin polarized agree. Right.
Can you compare it with experiments done above and below?
Well, the comparisons with it is at these experiments here, which had basically, you didn't see any features at all. And this was, we were a little bit astonished that here we would expect that DFT is good. But at least from what I learned this morning is it has to do a lot whether you detwin your crystals or you don't. And this is probably, Leonardo can say more about that than me. Because you say, Leonardo, that you have here some structure that was not seen before. But I would expect then that also in the experiments at higher energies, you don't have any more changes with temperature. Is this correct? because, yeah, okay. So this is, yes. No, I'm doing I'm doing LDA on my spin polarized functional, and then I put this U in order to reduce the magnetic moment, which just I'm shifting the scale. That's all. So, wait a second. This would be fine if look at this picture here of the density of states, and there you can see how much you change your system. So how much this perturbation is peak when you do this LDA plus U. And you see that the perturbation you do is in fact not. I think you are clear. The point is that when you do this, when you do this functional, I mean, and you look at the end of the day, with this functional, the term that you are adding is just this extra term here. So just sum it up to your LDA. I see your point. I see your point.
Cancel by the lag. The Hubbard model is still there.
Yeah.
It looks like it becomes.